Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello and welcome to the Rock on Tours podcast. I am Gary Kemp.
And I am Guy Pratt. All over the world, musicians are sat around with time on their hands and stories worth sharing. So even in lockdown, we are finding a way to make our little series happen.
And this week on the show, we're talking to one of the UK's finest songwriters, multiple Ivor Novello Award winner, Grammy-nominated storyteller, songwriting coach, an all-round great bloke, Mr. Chris Difford.
Chris, hello, how are you? Where are you? What the hell?
I'm at home in the village of Firle in East Sussex, and I can't tell you how extraordinary experience it is being at home, first of all, and not being on tour.
Yeah.
So I'm slowly getting used to being in family life, which is bizarre.
What are you doing? What's your day?
Well, the day is it's repetitive, let's say. you know, I get up at about 7 and the first thing I do is just sort of meander into morning. And then meander into afternoon, and then meander into evening.
That sounds like a lyric already.
It sounds like a Chris Difford lyric. Can I just say one thing? Because for people can't see this, right? That we do have a Zoom thing going on. That as all of us have sort of slowly fallen apart as the lockdown has dragged on, Chris still has the top button done up on his Fred Perry like a proper mod, and I said, yeah. It's amazing.
I've just got off my bike.
Were you meant to be on tour, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to think that this was going to be our most lucrative year. And we were going to be, literally this week was the rehearsal week, and then I wouldn't be home again until just before Christmas.
Has Glenn put you on furlough?
He's put me on something, but it is on furlough. And it's a real shame because we were going to be out in America supporting Hall & Oates, which is a tremendous ticket. We just did Madison Square Garden with them, and people really enjoyed it. So it's a shame to miss all of that. And then we were doing a tour with Madness and Jules Holland. So it was a very, very busy year.
You've done Madison Square Garden because you always had a funny thing, didn't you, where Squeeze were like massive on the coasts.
Yeah,
I mean, you've done Madison Square Garden off your own back before, haven't you?
We've done it twice before, and I don't remember either time because it was in the bad old good old days. And I remember having a fight after the first gig at my own birthday party. but that was all I could remember, and I think it was with a guy from Def Leppard.
Oh, did you win?
Well, he already had an arm in a sling, so I was kind of ahead of the game.
And then he got the drummer to back him up.
So let's go back to the beginning, though, Chris. How you found out you were a lyricist. What got you into music as a kid?
Well, meandering, I suppose, from as a young teenager, not really being that excited by school or education particularly or at all. I lived on a council estate in South London, and there was really nothing going on apart from being in a gang, which I didn't really want to do. So I kind of just sat at home, and then a friend of mine who lived like a couple of blocks away, he had like an Iggy Pop album. He had like the Stooges' first album, I mean, and he had the MC5 album, and he played it really loud, and it really attracted me to his house. It was like the sort of flute being played. So I went down and listened to that, and then a couple of months later, I went to my first gig, which was to see David Bowie, and that was the most turning point, really.
What tour was that?
Well, it was pre-Spiders. He was doing a bit of Jacques Brel and doing some of the stuff from Hunky Dory.
Oh, wow.
And he played at, it was at Eton College in South London. And everybody in those days would sit on the floor and watch concerts, cross-legged and sort of very intent, nodding your head. Mm. And he came down into the audience with his acoustic guitar. He had a blue 12 string, and he handed it out to people in the audience to strum along.
Wow.
And I don't know, on the way home, I just thought, that looks like he's having fun. That seems like the gig for me.
So did you start playing, how did you get your first guitar? Is that what happened, or you didn't start writing words straight away?
No, I was writing words before that. I've got some of them here. And it was just basically poetry, I guess, where it was. Very sort of floral and a bit hippie-like, if I suppose. Mm. But it was something that kept me amused and kept me out of harm's way. My two elder brothers had already left home, and it was just me, my mum and dad, and that was a little bit of a boring thing to be involved in. So I just sort of went to my room and wrote lyrics or poems.
There was nothing from that period that made it into a song later, was there?
No, not really. You know, I mean, I can grab a folder from up here and...
He blows the dust from off the top.
Elegy of the Afterworld.
Wow.
Oh, what?
Go on.
Yeah. Very prog rock. I suppose I was influenced a bit by King Crimson as well.
Oh, who had their own lyricist who wasn't in the band?
Yeah, what a great job.
What's his name?
Pete Sinfield. Who's not very well.
He went on to write for Dollar. It's fun, isn't it?
He wrote for Dollar, yeah.
So it's interesting. You were influenced by someone who was primarily a lyricist, right from the get-go, as it were.
I sort of half wanted to be in a band, but not. I wasn't that fussed. I would have rather just delivered the lyrics. You know, the Bernie Taupin life was for me, but it didn't happen because, you know, I met Glenn and I met Jules Holland and we got in a rehearsal room, and then suddenly it just sounded great playing guitar in a pub.
You don't just meet these people. How did it happen?
Well, I put an ad in a sweet shop window for a guitarist to join a band. I didn't have a band. I was just imagining I had a band. I imagined I had a record deal. And I imagined I had a load of gear as well. And nobody rang. It was just above bunk bed for sale.
How old
did you get
off
in a large chest, though?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I suppose I was 17 and Glenn was 15.
Oh, so you are the older.
Yeah, so I met Glenn, he was 15 and Jules was 15. They'd been at school together and that's how they connected.
And were they proficient players at that time? Or
Jules was extraordinary. He could play, you know, blues and boogie-woogie on the piano just like he does now, and it was something that I'd never heard.
Oh, my God, even then?
Even then, yeah. And, you know, I've got tapes that we made in 1973, and his piano playing at that time was exquisite, absolutely amazing. And Glenn, too. I mean, Glenn's guitar playing, when I first met him, he idolised Jimi Hendrix and therefore mimicked every Jimi Hendrix song. And he used to sit in his room and just play along, note for note.
And can I say, at that time, it was probably pub rock that was going on. Was it bands like Brinsley Schwartz, or is this before then? No, it's about that time, isn't it?
Well, pub rock was kind of not as not as full on as it was. Yeah, I mean, Brinsley Schwartz were definitely around. Ducks Deluxe were
Castle around, Flies.
But the Castle Flies. But Ian Dury and Elvis Costello and all that was 1976 onwards, I guess. We first got together in 73. Our first, we met a manager called Miles Copeland.
Who managed the Police,
and
right?
Then we...
Was he already managing then?
Yes, he managed Renaissance and Curved Air.
Oh, well, yeah, right.
And Climax Blues Band. So we went out and supported Climax Blues Band and Curved Air and Renaissance.
What kind of songs? What kind of songs were there at that time?
Renaissance?
No, you guys. Who are you? Because we all know you as a kind of... we all know your band as a sort of, you know, that post-punk sound, a very sort of tuneful Americana pop with lots of very sort of British working class lyrics in there. But that's not what you were doing, surely, in 73?
No, we played... We played Boogie Woogie and blues, and we played songs that we'd written that were a bit sort of bit poppy, I guess, a bit more poppy than we had become. And we had a bit of an attitude, but I don't know really what it was. It was kind of, we were still trying to find what we were doing, I suppose. It wasn't until we met John Cale that we found out who we really were.
What? Tell us.
How did you meet John Cale?
He produced our first album. He was managed by Miles Copeland as well.
That's how that came about.
So he got us in the studio in Pathway.
Spandau did our first demos in Pathway.
Yeah, so did we. We did 15 songs there with Baz.
15 songs?
Yeah, in one weekend with Baz.
And isn't it where Dire Straits apparently recorded their first the big hit single with was done in Pathway. It's a very tiny little box space.
Tiny place. Yeah, I know. And John Cale came along to listen to us perform the 15 songs that we demoed there. And he fell asleep in the rehearsal room. So he was a bit out of his head at the time. So Jules wrote C-U-N-T on his forehead with an indelible pen. And then we put him in a taxi and sent him back to his hotel in Millgate.
The Portobello, that would have been, I expect.
It was the Portobello, yeah. It was indeed.
And did you have a relationship then at that point together in that you were definitely the lyricist and Glenn was writing the music?
So. Yes, definitely.
And how would that work? Would that be Glenn said, here's a tune, or are you giving him the lyrics?
I would send him or give him 20 or 30 different lyrics completely written from beginning to end, and then I wouldn't see him for a month, and then he'd turn up with a cassette with 20 or 30 songs on it. And that would be the most exciting thing, waiting for the songs to come back and then to put the cassette in and listen to what he had done. And his demos equal Pete Townshend's demos. You know, they were like, he played everything on them and they sounded extraordinary. But it was really difficult for a drummer who wanted to be inventive himself, but Glenn had already invented all the drums.
So, what was the strike rate? I mean, it was basically, did a song come back for every lyric you sent him?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was extraordinary. You know, it was a very fertile time. Because, like now, we're in lockdown and it feels like 1973, 1972. It feels like, you know, I could just lie on the floor and write lyrics all day if I had that in my mind. But I'm not 17 years old anymore and there are other things to do.
Do you still have it? Because I have, when I've done your songwriting weekends and stuff, is that it seems writing lyrics seems like a tap that you can't turn off. It seems like they're just always pouring out of you.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I was more engaged in that person, the guy that writes lyrics. He's here, but he doesn't really engage very often at this present time. And I spoke to Glenn 3 weeks ago and we said the same thing, that it feels like the early 70s, wouldn't it be great to write loads of songs? And then I thought, well, what does it mean? I can't figure out what to write about and what does that mean in itself at this point in our life. Wow. So it's going to take a while for that to digest, and then something will come out.
I mean, were all your Would you say all your lyrics had a sense of autobiography about them?
Yeah, I think some of them had ex-wives in them, yeah.
and is that why it's difficult to write now, because the stories aren't happening around you that you can see? Or is this quite a big story though, isn't it? I mean, people on their own in houses.
Yeah, there's lots to write about. I've been following a photographer called Grace Della, and she's a nurse, NHS nurse, and she's a fantastic photographer. Every day she posts something on Instagram and you get very moved by it. But what's the story behind the person behind the mask? And that's really what interests me when they go home. You know, these are like soldiers, these people, and they're living a very dangerous life for us. But the photography always brings out something to write about, I think.
When you got those songs back from Glenn, did you ever feel, oh, you know, this isn't how I imagined it? Were you ever disappointed by that? And did it take you a while to get your ear around the scansion or whatever he's chosen?
Yeah, there's been occasions when I found myself being very grumpy in a rehearsal room trying to figure out what the chords were to the song that we'd just written.
And God, does he like a chord, I have to say. I played on stage with him. Yeah. Chord salad is the term we would use in the business. I mean, some of the most complex songs I've ever come across, ever tried to play.
I know, and in rehearsals it's mind-boggling sometimes. But then I step back from it and I think, actually, there's genius there. And, you know, like there was one song on the last album which almost had a different chord for each verse. Each verse structure had a different structure of chords. And when we played it live, you know, it was just like, what the hell's going on here?
I remember because you called and I had to send you a load of chords because you didn't have enough, right?
Well, no, because what's interesting here, Chris, is that because you do write technically incredibly complex lyrics as well. I mean, something like, you know, Up the Junction. Yeah. It's an extraordinary kind of endless stream of...
Yeah.
And something like that, by the way, which is so... technically brilliant. I mean, did that just fall out, or was that sort of endlessly worked and worked and worked?
That was written in New Orleans on our very first American tour. I was doing my laundry, and we'd already been away for 3 months on tour, which was a long time. And we were in New Orleans, and it was a scary place to be. And I was, you know, watching my smalls go around, and I just thought, I really want to be at home. And then I started writing about home. And that's what happened. Up the Junction just fell out of the pen.
If you don't mind me sharing a personal story, I do love the fact that your wonderful wife, went back when she was your girlfriend, and she was at one before you were together.
Are you sure you want to tell the story?
She was looking at, she was moving house and was looking at buying a place in Clapham, and Chris went, you know, you can't.
It's not going to happen.
Okay, it's not going to happen. You can't be my missus and live in Clapham.
No.
I mean, what's so great about something like Up the Junction is that it does have a sense of old world nostalgia about it. It's just a kitchen sink drama. I mean, it's in black and white,
yeah,
and yet it's so dense. I mean, do you think your head was in
Taste of Honey?
Yeah, exactly. Was your head in that sort of space of thinking about that kind of a Britain when you were down in New Orleans?
Yeah, because I was brought up on Wednesday plays on the BBC. And they were all fantastic, and they were all short and sweet and stories of domestic bliss in the 60s and 70s. And my mum and dad used to love watching them, so I used to sit up and watch them with them. And, you know, look at the people that wrote those and produced them. They're incredible people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was really... I was really locked into that.
I think Bernie Taupin said that he writes with other songs and tunes in his head that he won't ever tell Elton what they are.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc, and it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers, and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. Do you do the same thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Bob Dylan is a very good person to do that with. Yeah. Because of the scan of the way he sings, like, for instance... Tangled Up in Blue is a fantastic song on Blood on the Tracks, and it's such a simple rhyme. And if you get it in your head for long enough, you can just completely make it your own.
What's that program on the BBC where they sing a tune to different lyrics? Or
That was Tim Brooke Taylor. Wasn't it? Yeah.
If only they'd find the Squeeze song and a Bob Dylan song and found the actual marriage, it would be perfect. And so, going forward, in suddenly you become a hit band. What was that first moment? What was that song? When did you write that? Was it in the bag for a while before it suddenly became a hit?
Take Me, I'm Yours, isn't it?
What, Take Me, I'm Yours was the first.
Take Me, I'm Yours,
hit. Yeah. That was written a long time before we got to record it. And that was the day that John Cale was so unwell that he didn't make it in. So we decided not to waste the day, but to carry on and record something on our own, and that became our first hit.
No, I was going to say, because I remember reading, it might be one of your first, if not your first interview in NME when that was a hit. And in one of the big bold quotes, you slagged off the Sex Pistols. And I remember thinking, God, that's brave. It was something, I don't know if it was you, probably Glenn, who said, I thought the chord sequence from Anarchy was done.
Well, that would have been Glenn. I wouldn't have known what a chord sequence was in those days.
But Chris, what was the band that changed you from being, you know, maybe a prog rocker? What was the biggest influence upon Squeeze that made you the band you were, the kind of music you were going to make?
I don't think there could be a band, because we were five very different individuals with five different influences, and that was what's so brilliant about it, really, because we didn't all listen to the same music. So, you know, Jules would be listening to Fats Domino while Glenn would be listening to Can, let's say, and then I would be listening to King Crimson or Genesis or something like that, maybe, or The Who. Our drummer was probably not listening to anything, but we were all sort of basically listening to different things.
Our drummer was not listening to anything.
But there was a kind of music that was happening sort of in parallel with punk.
Yeah, I think I remember living in Deptford at the time, and there was this huge wake-up call, and the wake-up call came from Elvis Costello and Ian Jury, because both lyrically they were right in the middle of their brilliance. And when I listened to their early songs, I was just like, my God, this is where the template is, and I have to raise my game to be there.
There were a few artists that were making a sort of a sound that had a certain amount of America in it, much more than punk did. So, well, instead of the East Coast, it had something a lot more, maybe about, there was some country feel in there as well. Gram Parsons, maybe, is another artist at the time that that you seem to be in that world of. That it was happening at the same time as punk, but it was definitely more musical.
Yeah, I think,
punk.
Well, that's lucky, because we had five people that were coming from different parts of the ballpark. And also, you know, we were starting to hang out with people like Elvis Costello, who was introducing us to country music. And we toured with him and his band. You know, there was, you know, it was an incredible tour. We toured around America for 6 weeks, two bands on one tour bus. Can you imagine? Every bunk was taken. We had to have a security guy at each end of the bus to keep the drummers apart. Yeah, we had an accountant on the bus too, and the bus driver. So it was like really intense, but it was such great fun.
Did you ever sit down as a band and sort of decide what the band was going to be?
No.
And where did the name come from?
Squeeze came, we had lots of names in a hat, and Glenn's girlfriend's mother pulled the name out of the top hat. We could have been called Cum, for instance.
Spelt how?
C-U-M.
I know you sort of suffered still with some certain amount of dyslexia. It's interesting that, and you're quite open about that, but it's, and I've had emails from you, which I still can't read. but how does someone with dyslexia become a writer of words?
I've not really read many books in my life. I've got the concentration, and that's part of dyslexia, I think. Is, you know, I'll get like 3 pages in, and then I'll start thinking about what that bird's doing in the tree outside in the garden or something. And, you know, my head will just go completely somewhere else. I can't concentrate.
Is that why you think you were drawn to lyrics? I mean, I'm presuming that you always read lyrics.
Yeah, I always read lyrics, and, you know, from the Beatles and the Stones, obviously. But, you know, the first real records that I kind of tuned into lyrically were, oddly, you know, people like The Who, for instance, you know, like Tommy and Quadrophenia. The lyrics to those records are amazing.
Lyrics to Quadrophenia are some of the most accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely astounding lyricist.
But I can see the connection, because Pete, those in Quadrophenia and Tommy, that's a very much a storytelling lyric.
Yes, it is.
You know, you don't tend to write snapshots of emotions in your words. You tend to write things that are, you know, they have a tale in there, don't they?
Yeah, I like to work on a tale, definitely.
So let's go into your pomp now. Where was Squeezy's pomp? Where did you see that apex?
I think when MTV came about, we were the first people to play acoustically on MTV Unplugged. And our video for a song called Hourglass that came out around the same time got an MTV award, and it was on telly all the time. And that's really when the sort of pomp kicked in, I think. That's when we started to think, well, okay, we've got to get some decent suits. We've got to get makeup before we go on stage. You know, we had a makeup artist. We had somebody making us suits. You know, we started taking ourselves very seriously for the very first time, I think. And that's when we ended up playing Madison Square Garden and stadiums in America.
Wow.
And, you know, the rest of that kind of period, really, I don't really remember, because I just took the bull by the horns and enjoyed every second of it, but from underneath the table, basically.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, you talk a lot, you know, you're very open about that side of your life at that time. How did you write? Could you still write when you were stoned or speeding or whatever you were?
Yeah, there was always lucid moments on a tour bus or on a plane where there was the pen came out, and there were sort of, you know, whenever we were sitting, whenever the record company said, okay, we need another record, then you just sort of know that that's your time to get the pen out. And regardless of how you felt, that was your job, you know. And When I read some of the lyrics back from that period, I can tell that they were written at like 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, when I was completely useless, basically.
What was it Hemingway said? Write drunk, edit sober.
Yes.
When was the sort of split that was beginning to happen with Jules and you guys? What brought that on, do you think?
Oh, yeah, it was early on, wasn't it?
Yes. The first time we split up was... Jules had already left to go and form the band called The Millionaires, and he'd gone off to do The Tube, which TV show. And that was all great. And it was very sad when he left. It was like having one of your arms.
Why did he leave?
Well, he left because he wanted to express himself as an individual outside of Squeeze. I think he felt a little bit cornered by Glenn and me.
Because he wasn't a songwriter.
No, well, he was a songwriter, but he didn't get his songs on the album particularly. Miles, our manager, saw great potential in Jules as a TV presenter and put him up for the job of The Tube, and he got it, and that's where he went. It was very sad when he went. And then we started then Paul Carrack came into the band, and that was amazing. Then we were recorded with Elvis Costello.
How long?
How long was he in the band?
Sorry.
Very good. And then after all of that, after a couple more records, which sort of too many different keyboard players were coming and going, too many different managers were coming and going, there was no stability. We didn't know what we were doing, so we just sort of went, oh, let's just give it a rest. So that's what we did.
Wow, what year was that?
1984, I think.
There tends to be a thing, doesn't there, with bands that, though, is that once, as soon as you change your first management, nothing's ever quite the same.
Yeah, but we had Jake Riviera as our second manager, and he was extraordinary because he came with a lot of great ideas, and he wanted us to record a double album with different producers on each, producing a side each, Nick Lowe, Dave Edmonds, Elvis Costello, and Paul McCartney.
Wow.
And we went in the studios to record tracks to see if that would work, but the only one that worked was with Elvis, so we recorded the East Side Story album with him.
How much of the your issues with splitting up or had anything to do with, booze and getting wrecked, and did that have any... Play a part
I think
in
we
that.
Were all tired and slightly hungover. I mean, our farewell gig was in Jamaica, supporting Aretha Franklin and the Grateful Dead, and it was the greatest way to exit as a band. And I remember we all got in the lift at the hotel after the gig, and nobody said a word, and we all got out on different floors, and that was it.
But it's been amazing, the coming back, because I know that from my own point of view with Spandau, after years of hatred, maybe you go in and out of love and hate and love and hate.
Of course.
But you just think, well, you know what?
Of course.
You know, these people mean so much to me, in your case, obviously, Glenn as well, meant so much to you, that it seems foolish not to embrace them and sit on a bus with them again and remember those days. I mean, how did that come about? Was that tough getting back together with each other?
Well, we split up a few times. So that was the first time, there was a second time and a third time. And we're back together now, and we've been back together for 15 years, I suppose, on and off. And it's complicated because relationships just are, whether you're in a band or not. And but we make it work, and I have to say that playing on Madison Square Garden stage was an extraordinary experience, and I really felt, and everybody felt very emotional after that show. It was like, here we are, we're back here again, but in a much better place. The music sounded tighter, or is tighter, and I think, yes, we've got issues with each other, but we kind of deal with them.
It's family, isn't it? Family, like family, isn't it?
Just before we go, we should also talk about the fact you've written lyrics for other artists, haven't you?
Just the fact you do so much other stuff, Chris. I mean, all the things I've been involved with, you've been other things. An extraordinary breadth of, I don't know if it's just you feeling the need to keep yourself occupied, but also, and I've still got to say, you get the jammiest gig I've ever had in my life, which was being part of your songwriting course, crossing from Southampton to New York on the Queen Mary II.
Queen Mary, yeah, amazing.
Which was, well, amazing. I mean, how the hell you come up with these things?
Did you dine above the salt, guy?
It was whatever we wanted. We put on a show for all the crew, so they loved it, and we sat at the captain's table. We had everything. Amazing. We were above stairs, below decks, the lot.
It was amazing.
There's one gag I can share, which is when we did put the... Because Chris, very cannily, brilliant thing he did for the was he recruited songwriters, but everyone played a different instrument. So we had a band as well.
Yeah.
And I even got to do my comedy show in the pub there one night.
But brilliant.
We played for the crew, right, at the for the crew party, which meant they loved, which meant our cabins got made up beautifully after that. But I remember when I asked one of the stewards, I said, when are we going on? He said, you're on after the Somalis. And then this very nice bunch of sort of French young men got up to play, and it was the Sommeliers.
Oh, come on, you just rattle off. You've written with Elton, haven't you?
Yeah.
How was that, Chris?
Well, it was exactly what you'd imagine, really. He asked me to write a lyric. He gave me an idea. I sat up for a few hours and faxed it to him because he likes a fax machine, does Elton.
Bless.
So I faxed it to him, and then he called me up and said, would I come over to his house in Windsor? So I went to his house in Windsor, he sat at the piano. He put the lyric on the piano, and it was written within 5 minutes. And I was virtually in tears. I couldn't believe how quickly he'd knocked this song up. It was just like genius.
But hang on, was you in the room?
Yeah, I was just standing behind him.
Because famously, hasn't him and Bernie have never been in the same room?
That's right, yeah. That's right.
So you broke, wow.
Well, yeah, and then he said to me, let's get in the car and we'll go and record the song. And I said, what? We got in his Rolls Royce and we drove to studio.
To his home studio, the other end of the garden.
Yeah, in Bray. Yeah. And there was his band all ready, waiting. They just had their lunch and we sort of rocked up with the lyric and he sat at the piano, he played it twice for them and we recorded it and I was back at his house at 4 o'clock having scones and tea. It was done.
And what album was it on, did it?
It was on a duets album.
All right.
Yeah, it was the only song that wasn't a duet.
And you even managed Brian Ferry for a while.
Yeah, I managed Brian, who I adore. I absolutely loved working with him. And I managed Marty Pello, who I also really adored too. And it was an incredible lesson in just, you know, being in a different place. And then just recently I was managing a band called The Stripes, an Irish band.
Oh, yeah.
When I first met them, they were 15 years old and they were from Cavan in Ireland, and that was an
You managed to drag Chris Thomas out of retirement to produce them, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a very difficult lunch with him and he just didn't want to do it at all. And then Elton called him on his mobile phone when we were having lunch and he basically threatened him, I think. I don't know what with, but then we left the restaurant and he said, oh, okay, I'll bloody do it, you know. And we went to do it and he said, but I'll only do it 3 afternoons a week. But you can imagine,
that's probably enough for Elton.
Yeah, but for a young band, they didn't want 3 afternoons a week. They wanted 24 hours a day banging drums and stuff. So it was a hard thing to manage, but it was great fun.
Can I say, Chris, it's an absolute pleasure to know you in this business. There are a few people as nice as you and as easy, and we don't see each other a lot, but when we do, we're always, I think, happy to be in each other's company. I'm sure I can speak for Guy as well. Actually, I don't like
him. I never liked him.
Hateful man.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming out of lockdown onto Zoom.
Thank you. God bless. Good luck.
Well, that's all for this week. Don't know if you're in or out or home or out and about. Who knows where we are? But that's it from me and Gary.
Thank you. All the best. See you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.